And then,
I'm not here.
I don't know.
Everybody has to have a thing.
Let me put a reminder.
Ask if Eric or Jessica can call the roll.
If I get your name wrong, please just let me know. Layla Al Shaman. Anna El Zaire. Yishwa Barua. Nick Brennan.
Here.
B. Candelaria. Ana Fernanda Cardenas. Here. Paul Caruso.
Here.
Cameron Chappell.
Here.
Jason Chiburco.
Here.
Alessandra Coogan.
Here.
Isako Di Tomasu. Kelly Ellis.
Here.
Devin Freeman. Emma Rose Gallant.
It's Gallant.
Gallant.
So sorry, that literally happened.
It's okay. It's just an ant like the bug. So.
Andy Garcia Ortiz.
Present.
Irene Gattini.
Present.
Malte Hassler.
Present.
Mac James. Yusuf Khalid. Claire King.
Present.
Let's see, this is COVID. Anurag Quiada. Zong Yang Lu. Xander Lynch.
Present.
Clarice Mefford. Tian Nguyen. Marilise Ortiz. Reina Prude.
Here.
Katie Rohrbaugh.
Present.
Seem Sepp.
Present.
Ian Smith. Yuching Wu.
Present.
Jeffrey Wan.
Present.
Hongji Zhang.
Present.
All right, thank you. And that's quorum. At this time, we'll now move into approval of the February 9th meeting minutes. I'll entertain any motions. Xander is recognized.
Motion to approve the meeting minutes by unanimous consent.
It's a motion to approve the meeting minutes by unanimous consent. Second to declare. Is there any objection? Going once. Going twice. Seeing none. Then February 9th meeting minutes are now approved. With that, we'll move into reports of officers and committee updates, beginning with executive committee member.
Yeah, so today we have special guests. You guys can see the agenda. We have President Kalikoff's, Vice President Lombardi, and Dean Lewis. So we'll be welcoming them around like 5:30, as well as we prepare for elections in April. Woo!
Any questions for Anna for regarding Executive Committee and Elections Commission? Oh. Seeing none, we'll move over to the end of the operations and staffing committee.
All right. So we have a couple of chair positions available. So if you'd like to run for one of them, please do. Otherwise, there will be some like bylaws revisions coming down the pipeline in later in the semester. So if you'd like to get involved with those, you see them where that GPSA doesn't work exactly as you'd like it to, please let me know, and I'd love to get your help.
Thank you. Any questions for operations and staffing? Seeing none, we'll move over to appropriation committee.
Just normal ongoing work to help work in the issues out, especially friends, funds to be ready to move the money when Public Club has signed the resolutions. Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move over to communications committee. Andy?
Communicate will go out tomorrow. There's a lot of really notable events happening this week. Particularly, there's a depolarization event that's coming up, as well as GPSA is collaborating with the Future of the American University. It's having a big red barn. The information will be there, so look out for that.
All right, thank you, Andy. Any questions for communications? Seeing none, we'll move over to Student Advocacy Committee with Irene.
So, you know, same old, excited about town halls coming up. We've been working in collaboration now, talking about expanding town halls in relation to elections that are coming up, because we believe in, you know, having the people hear what our candidates have to say. And so that is still ongoing. Apart from that, no other updates.
Thank you, Irene. Any questions for Student Advocacy Committee? There being none, we'll move over to programming for.
All right, people. This Thursday, our first ticket drop occurs, I believe at noon, correct? All right. At noon, get your tickets. It'll be the first drop. It won't be all the tickets. So tell your friends. If your friends find out late, they don't get their tickets, more tickets will come. It'll be okay. But get your tickets now because you want to get that locked down. The gala is April 19th. It'll be at 7 p.m. Details will be on the website. And the link to get your tickets will be in the communique. So please look at the communique and read it. And then also peruse all the other special stuff that's in there. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Any questions for programming? Right, seeing none, we'll move over to Faculty Advising, Teaching, and Mentorship Award Committee. Jason.
Yep. Hello, hello. As you may have seen in the communique, please nominate any graduate student, postdoc, any colleague, faculty who made an overwhelming contribution to the excellence that we have here at Cornell. That is closing soon. So put in those nominations if you've been holding off, or if they come to mind, do it real quick. That is all.
All right, thank you, Jason. Any questions for FatMac? All right, there being none. Jason, I'm going to ask you again for updates on special grants, maybe for the last time.
Yeah, for the last time, yeah, as a unofficial chair since the committee no longer exists. So as you may see, we have the two remaining resolutions to discuss as per the special grants charge. They are for novel programming and student lounge grants. We will discuss those pending the appointment time, because I assume we might not be able to get fully through either of them before PublicConf gets here, but you will hear a lot from me and the co-sponsors when we get to that.
Thank you. Any questions for special grants? Right, seeing none, we'll move over to the graduate school. Is there a representative?
Yes, hi everyone. Dean Lewis will be coming up here soon, so he's asked that we speak on behalf of the graduate school for our reports. We just have two things to report. One is, you probably already know, admissions is what's going on across campus, and so our faculty are excited and looking forward to, you know, admitting their next crop of incoming graduate students, so that's happening. And the other thing is that the Big Red Barn manager position just went open this past week, and so we'll stay tuned, but I am hoping to have some representation on one person, hopefully, from the GPSA committee to be on, serve on the search committee. So we're hoping to have this done by May 1st. So we have a really accelerated timeline, but I'm hoping that we can get somebody in here and ready to go for the 11th A-grade box. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jenna. Any questions for the graduate school? All right, there being none, and with 20 minutes remaining, I'll entertain any motion. Andy is recognized.
I motion to move nominations and appointments next.
There has been a motion to move nominations and appointments to the top of the agenda. Do I have a second? Second from Irene. Do I have any objections? There being none, we'll now move into nominations and appointments. This time I'll call for any nominations, or sorry, is there a motion to open the floor for nominations for Finance Commission Chair? Motion from Andy. Do I have any second?
Rejected.
All right.
I would like this.
Oh, please make a motion.
I motion to open the floor to nominations for Diversity International Students Committee Chair.
Thank you. Do I have a second? Second from Irene. Any objections? Seeing none. I'll now ask, are there any nominations for the role of Diversity in International Student Committee Chair? Sam.
I'd like to nominate Dayun to be the chair.
Dayun, do you accept this nomination?
Yes.
Terrific. Yeah. All right. At this time, I'll ask if there's any other nominations for the role of Diversity and International Student Committee Chair.
I have this nice relationship, and it doesn't matter if you put price.
I don't think those were.
Going one, another nomination.
No, I motion to close the floor for nominations.
There's a motion to close the floor for nominations for DISC Committee Chair. Do I have a second? Second from Paul. Without any objection, the floor is now closed. Congratulations to our newest Diversity International. Welcome.
Howard. I mean, just so everybody knows, both of these positions means you can vote in today's legislation as well.
You're also a voting member. All right. All right. At this time, I'll ask, is there a motion to open the floor for Finance Commission Chair? A motion from C.
Motion to open the floor for Finance Commission Chair.
Do I have a second? Second from Andy. Without objection, the floor is now open for Finance Commission Chair.
Yeah.
I'll ask if there's a
point of information.
Yeah.
If somebody theoretically has a 20-hour TA ship, they still take this position.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It doesn't interfere because that's like the working.
This is not employment. This
no.
is
oh, like, okay.
Yeah.
Research.
Research.
Okay.
All right. At this time, I'll ask if there's any nomination to Finance Commission Chair. Team,
recognize nomination on my behalf to nominate Claire King as the chair of Finance Commission.
Claire, do you? Any other motion to close the floor to Mendes? Do I have a second? Second from Irene. Without objection, congratulations to Claire King. Okay, well, we sped right through the agenda. So at this time, we will continue to move right along into legislation, though we're probably going to have to cut it in the middle. And so at this time, I will welcome the sponsors. Sorry?
We want to maybe discuss the great book.
What about that? You'd like to.
Yeah,
I mean, we could save it for new business.
All right.
Xander is recognized.
I'd like to motion to add some time for discussion of like who we should put on the committee to elect the new quad. I forget what that farm manager.
Big Red Farm Manager.
Yeah, Big Red Farm Manager. So yeah, I'd like to open that up for discussion.
Do I have a second to that motion? Andy, second. All right. Without objection, I'll give you 2 minutes.
All right. So me and Nick have been fiercely interacting with Big Red Barn.
Nick.
And
all right, at this time, we're going to put a pause in that conversation. And I'm happy to welcome our presentation from today, President of Cornell University, Michael I. Kotlikoff, joined by Brian Lombardi, Vice President of Student and Campus Life, and Thomas A. Lewis, Dean of the Graduate School and Vice Provost for Graduate Education, as well as Dean of Students, Marla Love. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. I leave the floor open to you, President Kotlikoff, and then we can do questions.
Sure. Well, I received some questions. Are you going to, would you like me to make some general comments? And okay.
Yeah.
I haven't really prepared anything generally, but I'm always happy to talk off the cuff. I think the semester is going well. I'm happy to answer the questions that generally are around, I think, campus climate, issues of security, of how we're meeting the moment, if you will. And I'm very pleased to say that I think we have struck an effective balance around expressive activity on campus. By that, I mean that we've enabled people to express their First Amendment rights to protest when they feel so called upon, and however, not to violate the rights of other people. And so I think in this year, both last semester and this semester, we haven't had a single incident that I am aware of in which we've really had students or protesters of any kind cross that line and infringe on the rights of other individuals. On the other hand, we've had many, many examples of protests which were compliant with our expressive activity policy, time, manner, and place consistent, so that they can individuals can express their political views or views on any topic, and not disrupt classes, disrupt speakers, violate other people's rights. So I think from that standpoint, I'm very pleased with the campus. Obviously, we've also gone through a federal settlement. I'll answer some questions about that settlement, but I urge you all to read the agreement, because I think the agreement, if you read it closely, you'll see that the fundamental principles of Cornell are preserved. Our own autonomy as a university is preserved, and I'll go through some of that in my response to the questions. So, but glad to make this a conversation as well. So if there's anything that I say in response to the questions, glad to go into more detail.
Thank you, President Kotlikoff. Maybe we can do read off the question and get your response, and then
sure.
We can do any follow-up.
Sure. On that.
Annika, would you like to do this?
Yeah. How is Cornell balancing the enforcement of campus codes with the protection of free expression, particularly during periods of global conflict when tension on campus feels heightened? How does the university determine when conduct crosses from protected expression into policy violation?
Yeah, our lodestone here is the First Amendment. So, as I said, what we want to make sure is that people have the right to protest and voice their opinions. I think an example that I would give is the recent Anduril protest, where students felt that they were opposed to a group coming into campus and what that company does. But they did not disrupt the speakers that came in. They allowed those speakers to present their information, and the speakers chose not to enter into a dialogue with protesters and exited. But the protesters got a chance to make their points clear, but they did not shout down or prevent the Anduril spokespeople from having their presentation and presenting what they wanted to present. Another example is we've had several examples of very boisterous protests on campus. My inauguration was an example of, you know, walking into Barton Hall with people shouting at me and shouting at others going into the hall, but they were at a distance. They didn't disrupt the activity itself. And I think all of that speaks to our commitment to the amendment.
there's any follow-up questions to that, move on to the next.
Yeah,
please.
In regards to that, could you clarify, to me, the GPSA is like a democratically elected organization funded directly by the students. So would you say that our funds are not considered Cornell resource, in technical sense?
Well, we have a responsibility. I turn to Ryan here. We have responsibility for the oversight of those funds. So those are funds, I believe, that come from the student activity fee. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Cornell's responsible for. So if those funds are misused, Cornell is responsible for it. And so from that perspective, I think we have general oversight, but we try and balance that, you know, have students exercise their own views about how those funds should be used, but also have some oversight to make sure that those funds are not abused.
Okay, because in the regulations for like funding political organizations, it specifically mentions the additional guidelines for Cornell resources. And I was wondering whether these guidelines apply to GPSA funds.
Ah. So I'd have to ask the attorneys about that, but my guess is that they do, because we charge them, we collect them, and we make them available for distribution. So my guess is that they would include that. And Ryan agrees with
that. I mean, I'm just a guess. I don't know. I'm not the attorney, but there's other, you know, tuition is paid 100% by students, right? But those are still considered Cornell resources because we have to steward the use of them. We, as Mike said, we charge them, we collect them, housing fees, dining fees, et cetera. A lot of the revenue comes from students directly. So I'm guessing that would be the response there.
It's not my favorite too far, but thanks for yours.
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Katie is recognized.
Thank you. Yeah, so you talked about students following campus policies, but what about the university following its 2016 divestment guidelines, which is why there are protests at your inauguration and why there's protests for these Anderle meetings? Thanks.
I'm sorry, so in what way has the university not followed its 2016 divestment guidelines?
So the 2016 divestment guidelines specify that the Cornell should divest from morally reprehensible activities and companies that are complicit in those activities. So Anderle is the sponsor of watchtowers and weapons used at the border that murder people trying to pass the border. Like Lockheed Boeing also sell weapons that are used in genocide in Gaza. So those are considered morally reprehensible. So theoretically, Cornell, by its own policy, should divest from them.
Yeah, I think the active word there is theoretically. There's a mechanism that is specified in the 2016 guidelines about how to appeal for or propose that the university divest from some activities. That goes through shared governance. It goes through the president, goes to the board of trustees. None of that has been followed in this case.
With that, maybe so we get through more different topics, we'll move on to question two.
So this one's about expansion of campus surveillance and student privacy. People believe that there's more cameras. And with that said, they ask, what was the rationale behind the recent increase in surveillance cameras on campus? What is the university ensuring transparency in this expansion while also protecting student privacy and civil liberties? And as well as, how long is surveillance footage retained? Who has access to it? And under what circumstances can it be reviewed, shared, or released?
Yeah, so the university is expanding its cameras on campus and its swipes for buildings. Much of this comes in the wake of the Brown tragedy. Our first responsibility here is to ensure the protection of our community. We're not expanding surveillance. We're not in the business of surveillance, but we do need to have cameras and the ability to lock down buildings. This is one thing that we saw was inadequate in the Brown response. I would say we have a university policy 8.1, which covers physical security systems. It's available online for anyone to see. The footage is retained for 14 days. In general, video footage is not viewed unless there's a crime or a violation of policy and some reason in which the campus has some liability. At that point, then it is reviewed. It's reviewed by a number of university agencies, but it has nothing really. Cornell is not in the business of surveilling its community. Sure, please.
One of the things I'd like to add on this question, I was quoted in a different context around surveillance, and it was referring in these camera situations. When I was hired at Cornell in 2015, I was asked to do a lot of work on the residential experience. We've got a lot of new residence halls on campus. We've renovated other residence halls. We made a commitment at the time as we were doing residential spaces to make sure there were cameras in the vestibules, the entry points of all of those residence halls, purely from a safety and security perspective, like Mike mentions. And so as we've been building new residence halls and renovating them, that's where we've been putting cameras. They're not inside the buildings. They're not in private spaces or anywhere close to private spaces, literally just at the doorways, because we were having trouble with crimes happening where people were getting into the residence halls and stealing things or threatening to assault residents, those types of things. And so that my explanation of that has been used in other ways. So I just wanted to clarify when I've talked about increased cameras, that's what I was referring to in those residential spaces as we renovated our residential housing inventory.
And I guess the overriding point we don't want to miss is we have an open campus. We have a campus in which we really prize the fact that people can access our buildings. We don't have locked buildings in general, and we want to maintain that as much as possible. We also have to balance that, of course, with the security of our community.
Thank you. Are there any follow-up questions related to expansion of campus surveillance? Paul?
I think that the question in itself is a little narrow towards the cameras themselves, but you bring up a larger issue of increasing security. Are there other measures that round out the kind of security that you're talking about besides cameras?
Yeah, so it's a great point. We've had a recommendation, a Kroll report, at one point about, particularly after the incident where a student threatened individuals and was held criminally liable for that. In the wake of that, we had a Kroll report about security on campus. They made a number of recommendations about size of personnel, security personnel, how to handle events, et cetera. We have a broad approach to this. So it's not just about cameras and swipes. But I will say that the Brown incident indicated that if you don't have the ability to lock down buildings or see what's happening in spaces, particularly where there's a high density of congregation of students, you're really not doing your job. And so we want to make sure that we have the ability to do that, particularly in those areas. We're prioritizing those areas where there's high student congregation.
I might put in a plug for the Rave Guardian app too, which is, if you're not familiar with it, you can download on your phone. It's something we've really been talking about trying to proliferate the use across campus. It's a great resource. You can put a timer on there when you're walking home late at night to make sure that if you don't notify the app, then the police will reach out to you and check to see if you're okay. There's lots of good resources like that. So,
and looking to upgrade that,
and
right?
Potentially looking to upgrade that with additional functionality. Marla's got it.
I would just add, just in this conversation around like surveillance and security outside of cameras, there are more unarmed public safety ambassadors, what we call them. And so you're seeing more vehicles that say public safety ambassadors, you're seeing more public safety ambassadors. That was in really response during COVID to how might we change situations where we don't need police, but we do need someone that's thinking about public safety. And so that has been a new group of individuals that are uniformed, not like police, but might be perceived as, while there are just more individuals surveilling, if you will. But that really was coming out of some of the requests from students to say, I'd rather interact with this person instead of a Department of Police officer. Some of the work that's coming out of the Public Safety Advisory Committee. And so that's another area where you might see, while there are more people coming out of public safety, but really in response to lots of different situations in which students were asking for an alternative safety measure or safety organization on society.
Thank you. Any other further questions on campus surveillance? Katie?
Yeah, so prior to the Brown tragedy, Cornell allowed several Flock cameras installed on campus, or Flock, if you didn't hear me. So why do students not have meaningful input on whether these cameras were installed? And similarly, generally with like all cameras on campus, how like why don't what are the meaningful ways that students have to put like have input on whether or not they're surveilled on campus?
Again, students are not surveilled. These cameras are not used for surveilling anyone in our community. We've gotten professional advice or recommendations about where to put cameras and how to increase security on our campus. I think that's our responsibility. It's really not a you know, a vote about whether to put them here or there. It's really about how to provide a safe environment for our community.
Thank you. I think we can move on to question three regarding federal influence and institutional autonomy.
Have recent interactions with federal government influenced campus policy decisions? How does Cornell maintain institution autonomy and uphold its core values while responding to external political or regulatory pressures?
Yeah, I think that the short answer is no, government policy has not affected Cornell's policies or regulations. If you read the agreement, you'll see that there's nothing in the agreement that changes our policies. Settlement is an excellent example, I think, of us prioritizing the principle of university priorities. There's no policy changes. There's no enforcement changes. There's no data provided beyond what is legally required. There's no external monitor or external approval that's in that agreement. All of this was a principle of our negotiation as we went through this with the government, that we are a private institution. We maintain our own policies. We decide who to hire, who to admit. None of that has changed. I'll leave the question for later about the DEI issues, et cetera. But I do want to emphasize that within this overall, if we make changes to Cornell policies, those are changes that we make because we perceive that we're not obeying the law or we have some risk of being out of compliance with federal guidelines. Or federal law, let me put it that way. And that's why we would make any changes to our policy.
Thank you. Are there any follow-up questions regarding federal influence? Right, moving on to student amendments and administrative dialogue.
There's a perception that student-led amendments are often treated as unfriendly or oppositional. How can the administration foster a more open collaborative dialogue with students and create space for forward-looking conversations rather than relying primarily on historical context when responding to concerns?
You know, great question. I completely agree that shared governance really depends on mutual respect, appropriate collaboration between administration and shared governance bodies. I think this meeting is an example of trying to interact and answer questions and act collaboratively. I would welcome Tal, Brian, and I. Marla would be glad to meet with leadership of the GPSA as required or requested. I think through that kind of discussion of the complexities of some of these issues, I think we can all come to an agreement or a consensus about how to move forward. So I welcome that and look forward to continuing a collaborative relationship.
Go ahead. I want to say to you. Well, I was just going to say, you know, as I think about my last 7 months here, I've been tremendously grateful for the opportunity to engage with all of you. I mean, most weeks when we have one of these meetings prior to this meeting, we had a conversation. Some of the graduate school leadership, including myself, and some of Nick, Anifer, and others. And those have been really valuable. And for me, just sitting in on the rest of your meetings gives me a sense of the tenor, what's mattering. And those are things that then I'm sharing when I'm speaking with Ryan, with Mike, with the provost. And so all of those kinds of conversations and opportunities to get to know each other better, hear about those concerns, I think those are really vital to then building the kind of relationships where when something more critical comes up, we can talk about that and really put that. So thank you for that. And I'm really grateful.
I was just going to add briefly, I thought the, for example, the resolution that you all put together, you're the one governance body that put together really thoughtful and specific suggestions around the code, which was very well done. And the committee, I listened in and they were considering those and really talking about them and giving Nick the opportunity to represent. Like, it was really good and thoughtful. You were the one body that put those level of detail together. So thank you for that. I would just also express my openness. If there's ever a resolution like those things around an issue that that's in my kind of locus of influence, I welcome a conversation in advance of the resolution too, not to change the course. I mean, you should do the resolution, but sometimes it can help inform. Here's some issues that we're thinking about. You might want to think about this when you're considering your resolution. I think that'll make for the most effective resolutions and the most likelihood for success going forward. So I just want to offer that.
Yeah, and I would add the expressive activity policy. I think the interaction with GPSA and that was, we're not always going to agree, but I thought it was a thoughtful interaction.
Thank you. Are there any follow-up questions regarding student administrative dialogue? Alexander.
I just had a kind of question to what you were talking about. In terms of like how do we as a body know kind of who we should approach? Because like we are looking for those kind of nuance, those kind of detailed aspects, but sometimes it's just like who in
bureaucracy, right?
Yeah, exactly. So who in administration should we go to? And you know, even sometimes when we talk to like Tal, we can't always know like if that's the direct person that we should be talking to. So yeah. Do you have advice? Do the three of you have advice? Or
I guess my suggestion would be through these regular meetings with Carl, if things, if you want to or feel that things should be elevated or brought in other people, don't mean to get obviously in the way of that relationship, but the provost is open, I'm open, Ryan's open, so. You know, please, if you think there's something that we can add to the conversation or some information we can provide, happy to do it.
Yeah, I know it's a big, messy place. And so sometimes just asking, like, who's responsible for X, right? You know, getting that
right
first. And I know Cal will know that, Marley, yeah, and we can.
And of course, we don't want to get in the situation, I didn't like the answer from him or her, so I'm going to go to him or her, or so on. Right. You know, that's it.
Thank you. Also. Jason.
Yeah. Hello, hello. So last meeting on the 9th, we passed three resolutions that effectively earmarked money for a large number of proposals that we received through the Special Grants Initiative, if you're familiar with the work that was done there. One of the questions that I had was on the 17th, the three of those resolutions was conveyed to you, Kalikov, and I want to know the timing that you'll have on responding and potentially accepting those, since we are delayed a bit in submitting or sending funds out to these organizations based on your acceptance. And then likewise for the two resolutions we have on the docket today, those will spend or earmark the remaining funds.
Yeah, yeah. So we've really had some issues meeting the 30-day deadline for resolutions. And part of that is the number of resolutions that have come in and when they've come in. So, and this is mostly from the SA, but we've had, you know, a group of 10 resolutions on a single day, you know, not far from the Christmas break. And each one of those resolutions has to be, data source. People have to look into it. What are the issues there and provide some recommendations. We'll make every effort, particularly if you indicate that there's some time sensitivity to specific decisions or use of money, et cetera. We'll make every effort to try and get it back as quickly as possible.
Yeah. If that's the case, then I would like to make that plea for the
ignore the resolutions at hand
too. And,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and those would be resolutions, if I recall, 8, 9, 10, and then 11, 12 for today's document.
Okay.
Just fine.
All right, thank you. With that, we can move to tracking religious harassment and campus transparency.
How is Cornell measuring and tracking incidents of religious harassment, including Islamophobia and anti-Semitism? Thank you. What mechanisms are in place to ensure accurate reporting and consistent categoric and follow-up?
Yeah, I think there's sort of two answers to that question. We have those incidents that are reported, and then we have the ones that are not reported. So if incidents are reported, we have, you know, in the last few years, we've set up the Cornell Office of Civil Rights, COCR. They're charged with investigating every one of these issues, deciding, determining whether it's a Title VI violation. There's an attorney that runs that office. They're very effective, I think, in figuring out whether this is really a Title VI, illegal harassment or discrimination. And if it's not, if it's simply an incident that does not rise to that level, then it goes over and it's a student-to-student issue. It will be a code issue. But we do keep track of all that. It's on the website, centralized reporting of biased incidents we've had since 2000. They're reported via the Guardian app or civilrights@cornell.edu. And if you look at the COCR website, you'll see by year a report of all those incidents, all public. Now, in addition to that, we have incidents that are not reported, where things occur and students don't report them, or others don't, the faculty or staff don't report them. For that, we have the survey that we do of our community that asks about bias incidents. We track that year on year. We've done that every few years, and we track that carefully. We'll now be doing that every year. And that's also a way for us to understand the anonymous, things that are happening on campus that are not reported, but are part of the atmosphere of our community, and whether it's getting better or worse, or where it's feeling the stress.
Thank you. Are there any follow-up questions to tracking religious harassment and campus transparency?
I have a follow-up question. I'm just wondering if you take into consideration any other metrics for talking about these incidents, like the CARE reports, which rated Cornell a hostile campus with a score of 27%. I'm wondering if there's any preliminary action, not based off of just submitting things that have happened, but taking these external things into consideration and talking about them at higher levels. Because I know that we as a group are concerned about it, and there are a lot of people that I talk about that want to make sure that, you're aware of other institutions that are talking about how we treat Islamophobia on our campus.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tricky, we're aware of those surveys. And, we're also aware of some of the limitations of those surveys. We've had surveys on Islamophobia. We've had surveys on anti-Semitism. Some of those, the population, the sort of sampling bias that goes on, who's asked, et cetera. What we find is we have a very solid survey process for our community, but we also do take a look at these surveys and try and think, is there something there that we're missing? So absolutely.
Yeah. So there's just like a quick follow-up, not necessarily a question, but something that is included in the report, but is not due to maybe selection or any kind of like polling, is that Islamophobia and anti-Muslim bias is not specified in the anti-discrimination policy, is what they have listed. So I think that that's something I'd like to bring up and just vocalize. And I would appreciate y'all to look into that further.
So your concern is that Islamophobia itself is not specified,
yes,
in which of our policies, 6.4?
It just said anti-discrimination. I have not looked into it further past that.
Okay. We'll take that under advisement and look at the way that I think the appropriate policy is policy 6.4 and mm-hmm. how that's framed.
Yeah, and I think that just comes in conjunction with the agreement to take care of anti-Semitism on campus, which is very, very important, and that is very, very important to me, but I think we should also take other groups
just
as seriously as when we're making these agreements on the federal level.
Certainly, and just to be just to clarify the agreement part of this, that certainly the government's interest was that any survey included a survey around anti-Semitism, but the government doesn't write the survey; we write the survey, and any survey that we do will be inclusive of all kinds of bias.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure of that.
Sure.
Any further follow-ups on this point?
It's very short, back to Jason's point. I think the most time-sensitive resolution is resolution 10, also because it promotes religious and cultural celebrations, which are very time-sensitive. But I think, especially in what we just talked about, this would be really great if those could happen this semester.
Okay. Well, they will happen this semester.
I know. I'm just saying, like, if you tennis, I think the most sensitive.
Yeah, okay.
Keep that in mind.
Thank you. In the interest of time, we'll move to question 6, federal anti-DEI guidance and institutional response.
Go ahead.
The United States Department of Education recently dropped its appeal of a federal court ruling that blocked the administration's anti-DEI guidance, effectively acknowledging that the legal basis for that guidance was unsound. How does this shift affect Cornell's ability to reinstate or strengthen diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that may have been paused or limited due to concerns about federal funding penalties?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any initiatives that have been paused. We have had certain racially exclusive programs in the university that have always been illegal. And as part of this, we've made sure that those programs are either inclusive, so allow all to participate, or we don't have them, because racially exclusive programs, a program that only allows a certain race or ethnicity to participate, is illegal. That's the only thing that through this process we've gone through and tried to make sure that we're strictly obeying the law in that regard. So not aware of any DEI policies that we've eliminated. Certainly the settlement doesn't require us to do anything of that kind.
I think in this context, it's also worth highlighting the work that the Graduate School, for instance, is doing in working with fields on their admissions process. It's one of the things, given what's been in the news, as well as the Supreme Court ruling from 2023, there's a lot of uncertainty out there about what is and isn't legal. And one of the things we've done is really work with programs to identify what practice. Yes, there are certain things that aren't illegal, but we also don't want to, that aren't legal, but there are certain things that we don't want to overreact. And so really providing clear, legally compliant guidance and use of best practices around rubrics and this kind of thing, precisely to highlight the importance of cultivating the kind of intellectual community with people from diverse backgrounds and experiences coming here. And that has been something we've valued and continued to put a lot of energy in it.
And just to highlight again, it goes without saying, diversity is extraordinarily important for this campus. It's important to have diversity, racial and ethnic diversity, diversity of experience, socioeconomic diversity, geographic, international. All of that is so precious to this university. So that's something that's we're committed to, any person.
Any follow-up questions on the point of federal anti-DEI guidance? Right. Seeing none, we can move along to question 7, foreign adversarial presence and international institutional safeguards.
How does our university monitor and manage potential foreign adversarial presence or influence on campus? What systems or safeguards are in place to identify, assess, and mitigate such risks?
Yeah, it's a great point, and one that's becoming more important. So cyber risks, we've seen Harvard, Columbia, Princeton, recently Penn, Dartmouth, all have cyber attacks that were to one degree or another very, very harmful. We talk about this all the time. We had a tabletop last year. We're planning another tabletop on these cyber threats. What I'm told is, you know, the number one vulnerability for cyber threats is us, you know, a phish responding to a phish, letting people in through that process, letting them get your IDs, et cetera. We have a lot of training processes in place to try and do that, and also additional measures to try and detect this and eliminate it as quickly as possible. So all of that is extremely important. And so far, we've managed to avoid some of the things that have happened to our peer institutions. But we have a cybersecurity committee that looks at this and makes sure that we're as bulletproof as possible, and making sure that even areas of the university that are at a distance or not technically part of the university, but have access through their university ID, that we have we secure all those ports of entry into our systems. On the foreign influence and import export controls and that sort of thing, also extremely important, something where the risks are increasing all the time. We have a robust set of controls around this, particularly in the research sphere. We look at this, we're upgrading those policies now. We're making sure that both we understand all of the kinds of collaborations and activities that our faculty undertake with individuals in areas in which they might be compromised. So all of that is very important. We take it very seriously. And all I can say is that we're putting a lot of focus on making sure that we're as safe as possible.
Are there any follow-up questions regarding adversarial presences and our safeguards against them? Right. Seeing none, that finishes the pre-submitted questions. If you're willing to take any remaining questions, happy to open the floor. Brandon?
Hello, thank you for having this conversation with us. Just a quick question, is there any commitments to, like, I know that you just talked about that surveillance on campus cameras on campus are not there to surveil students. And so are there any commitments for to never like take any contracts from like AI companies to help with maybe monitoring these cameras, or if it's always just going to be kind of disassociated from potential AI companies or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I can think of some areas in which, so let's think about a situation in which something occurs, some criminal event occurs, and we have weeks of camera footage from hundreds of cameras across campus. I can imagine a situation where we might go to an external security expert that might use AI to be able to monitor this. But I can assure you, I think what I hear from you is concern that somehow we'll be using this information and we'll be providing this information to companies that can use it in a way other than what we're trying to use it for, which is to detect criminality or breach of our policies. And that I can assure you we won't do. We will never surveil our students or be in a situation where we're trying to provide information outside of the university, assuring that its laws are that anyone that breaks its laws is detected and punished.
Thank you.
Other questions for President Kolakoff? Katie?
Yeah, kind of following up on that, because I think it's hard to make assurances about whether or not like an outsourcing company will not like use AI in a way that doesn't like actually work. So the example I'm thinking is recently, I believe a 12-year-old had a like bag of chips, and an AI read that bag of chips as a gun and called the cops on this child who's also black. And so how can you be sure, like, like how can you make assurances that AI won't just repeat like ra very racialized patterns of image recognition, and like when you don't even know if it's being sent to a third party, and all in the name of like stopping criminality, when criminality is also defined by these like racist AI and data providers.
Yeah, again, a tough one, Katie. I mean, I guess my only answer would be if if we seek outside expert help in investigating a crime, et cetera, we are in control of the data. We take our responsibilities to our community very seriously. We're not going to open this up in a general way for a fishing expedition. My only problem is, if you ask me carte blanche, will we never agree to use AI in video surveillance? I really have to say it, it may be a help in detecting someone that has or is a threat to commit violence on our students. So I just would be very reluctant to try and provide that assurance.
Any further questions for President Kolakoff, Dean Lewis, and Vice President Lombardi? Katie.
Claire.
Sorry. I thought Dean, and I thought Katie. There.
I work on the Geneva campus as a plant breeder, and I'm wondering about the transparency of how I know where that $30 million is going and who towards. Because in the grant, in the agreement, it says it's not specified. But maybe there's an emphasis on AI and robotics, and such as like digital agriculture and future farming technologies. However, in the Geneva campus, there are not many labs that have the funding or desire to work with AI. Most of us are traditional breeders, pathologists, those kinds of things. So how do we make sure that these $30 million doesn't go directly to one of the two labs that work with robotics up in Geneva? And how are you ensuring that this process is transparent to students who might not want to be funded by this $30 million?
Yeah. Well, we're about to release an RFA, a request for applications, for that is open to everyone, every Cornellian. So every lab can apply for this. There'll be clear guidelines that are issued as part of that RFA. It'll be very transparent about who is funded as part of the RFA. Everybody will see that, who's funded for how much, et cetera. So all of that will be open.
All right, seems we have about 2 minutes left. Is there any last question? Yuqing.
I know we've covered a lot of very different questions, but like in
Oh, I'm
your
sorry, the
view,
what question?
oh, we just covered a lot of different
Oh,
questions
okay.
today. But in your view, what are the main challenges facing Cornell in the foreseeable future, like the coming few months?
Yeah, well, we've talked a lot about resilient Cornell and making sure that we're able to continue to invest in our mission. And our mission is student success and the student experience on campus, research, and our impact broadly in the community, our patients at Weill Cornell Medicine, et cetera. So what I'm a bit concerned about is we've been so constrained financially. A number of There's no one thing that defines this, but a number of areas have created the kind of pressure on the university where we're really in difficulty, behind in, for example, our deferred maintenance of our buildings. We're not in a place where the provost has resources really to invest in excellence. Recruiting faculty, building programs for student success, et cetera. So that's the thing I think we have to take. This is a huge organization. It's got lots of bureaucracy. It's something where we need to make sure we're as efficient as possible, and we're focusing on our mission at to the degree that we can. All of these other things are important. Security, for example, is very important for our campus, but we have to make sure that we continue to invest in excellence. And that's what Resilient Cornell is all about. And it's something we just have to succeed in.
At this time, I'd like you to join me in thanking President Kotlikoff, Vice President Lombardi, and Dean Lewis for their presentation today.
They want to get frugal up and
have a good evening.
All right. With that, we will now move into the legislation portion of our agenda this evening, beginning with Resolution 11. I'll call on sponsors Jason Chivirko to the side of the front of the room, and Xander Lynch, who's not listed. Thank you, Xander.
Cool.
All right. All right. I will give Jason and Xander 2 minutes to introduce Resolution 11, implementing Special Grant Committee funding recommendation on proposals addressing novel programming. 2 minutes, whenever you're ready.
All right. So this proposal, which I don't know why I look back there, this proposal is kind of one of the two pillars of what this fund was really supposed to be about. We wanted to make both lasting improvements and also help to like kickstart some new programs that then could kind of be used as a proof of concept to show this actually works. We actually engage the community in this way, and then allow those organizations to use that to find other funding sources. So I think while this proposal seems very large in terms of its actual amount of funding, it's also one of or the largest in terms of the diversity of organizations that it's funding. So I think there are some excellent programs in here. I've already talked a little bit more in the first kind of like short presentation about them. But happy to take any questions. One that I already talked about was bringing the powwow. Was bringing a powwow to Cornell and to the Ithaca area. I think that's great. That's one of the larger chunks of money, but it's also one of the ones that would be more open to the campus generally, and it'd be kind of a larger event. There's also one for from the Graduate Student Veterans Association. So this is more family focused. This is something that I think Cornell generally and GPSA more specifically doesn't provide a lot of resources for, which is students with families and especially students with young families. So this would be to instantiate a program, I think just a one-time program, to provide new families with some of the like materials like diapers and wipes that they need to get through those first couple of months. And then there's also some others like the Lindsay Climbing Center. One of the grants provides additional funding so that they can improve and upgrade what they can offer.
Yep. Right. Thank you, Xander and Jason. We'll now move into question and answer period. Are there any questions for our sponsor? Yeah, there for the part of the update.
Yeah, if you'd like.
Entertaining any questions related to Resolution 11? Annie?
In the Linda Climbing Center, there's a section that says membership discounts.
Mm-hmm.
No, you happen to know what said discounts are?
So as per their proposal, which again, to reiterate, all of the grants are available online on Box. If you're a voting member, you should have access so you can look at them at your leisure. But for the Climbing Center, they had a number of requests for different avenues of funding theirs. The ones that we, as the Special Grants Committee, ended up recommending for funding was specifically after the ability of them to recruit or otherwise advocate or advertise memberships for graduate and professional students, we would reimburse them a subsidy. So effectively allowing graduate and professional students to gain access to the Lens of Climbing Center at a discounted rate compared to the normal market price, which if I recall correctly, last I checked was like a few hundred dollars for an annual pass, which It is still a discounted rate, mind you, but if you're an avid climber, it is something that, you know, you have to put in your budget. So hopefully more people would get to use it as a consequence.
I think the yeah, I think the actual number or the actual like discount would be something they have to work out once they get the money and see how many people are actually in this.
Indeed. It is not a blank check to just give them 10K. They have to tell us how many graduate professional students used the service, and then we will pay them as a consequence.
Other questions pursuant to Resolution 11? Seeing no questions. Oh, please, Alfonso.
Question, a follow-up on the Linda Learning Center. I'm not sure how many people are aware, but some people have been successful in getting reimbursements for MGM memberships through their insurance. So I don't know if this factors that in whatsoever.
Yeah, so I attempted desperately to get that to work. However, in order to do that, you need to visit 50 times within a 6-month period.
Right.
And I was not up to the task. And of course, 50 days separately, but that option is available, but this would be a separate
Okay.
avenue for.
I think also another thing to remember is that while many of us may have insurance, especially PhD students may have insurance provided by Cornell, not everybody who comes here has that same kind of like opportunity.
Yep, especially for like the professional students.
Other questions? Eugene?
I can see that under grant number 11, so page 113 talks about funding furniture for the graduate lounge.
Right.
I'm under the impression that furniture is under another category.
Correct. So,
Why? Okay.
yeah, I apologize for interrupting. I just wanted to highlight. So, while we blocked the proposals as best as we can, this grant in particular had a number of different initiatives.
I see.
So, in terms of blocking it with the one that it fit with most, we allocated this for novel programming since it also has a number of other things that they would do as part of the grant fund.
Okay.
Yeah, and to reiterate, that would be the writing workshop series and movie nights that were the main reason why that grant was slotted into this kind. So the alternative would have been splitting that grant into two parts, which would have been a slight cost. Cameron?
Can I motion for an amendment to the
Please.
motion? I would like to amend line 68 through 122 to add in the requested amount for each grant. Yeah. So like $100 of 2,000 requested, just for additional component.
Sorry, to be clear, you're referencing Resolution 11, line 68.
Yeah. Starting with the first funding amount and then ending with the last. So like at each funding amount, 50,000 of 100,000 requests. I think that's important information.
I see. So the amendment would read lines 68, 72, 78, 82, et cetera, would list the proposed amount out of the total amount requested.
Yes.
Yeah.
Point of information.
Yeah.
Is that proper?
Yeah.
Okay. If we do this amendment, would it delay getting these people money?
It would theoretically minimally delay because we would just have to edit the resolution.
But we can like pass it today
Yeah.
and
I will.
I don't know if we can pass it today. I think we need to have the amendment in writing.
All right. So I'll ask now, Jason, do you take this amendment? Jason and Xander, do you take this amendment as friendly? I mean, the question
I'm
of the offer.
inclined for a number of reasons to say
Not taking this friendly.
Correct.
All right.
Do you have any?
I agree.
All right. Cameron, you have up to 2 minutes to present further if you'd like. And at that point, we'll move into voting on the amendment.
Sure. Yeah, I just thought from our last meeting, it's important to know how much each group requested because several groups made a point to say that the amount of money they received just would not be enough to put on the original event that they planned. So it's as if we should not have even funded them anything to begin with. And I think it's like a minor change just to put of the requested blank amount of dollars, especially considering like the point of like this resolution was to succinctly prepare it for all of us members who weren't on the special grants committee, who didn't review each proposal and know how much each group like requested. And even though we can go back in and see how much each group requested, like, who has time to do all that? Like, if one person did it, then we all could see it. I just think that's important.
You see your time. All right, Jason and Xander, you have up to 2 minutes to counter.
Yeah, indeed. So while I agree generally with the sentiment that you have, when it comes to the resolution, that information is superfluous. Not to say that it isn't important, but it isn't a key component of actually allocating the money that the Special Grants Committee recommended. While I understand that it would be a little extra sent, like few words to be like out of X, that in many cases could raise a number of questions about why one proposal received $500 out of $10,000, rather than emphasizing the money that we're giving to the proposals and the grants themselves. That's generally why I didn't include it in the resolution initially, but if there's interest broadly, we can change it. That's just the thinking behind the initial method.
Can I ask a question? So like, what is the kind of concern? Like what are you trying to get at with knowing that? What would you think would be important about knowing that amount of money? Because maybe we can answer it in a different way without having that exact amount. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess the concern was just, I want to be judicious with my words, a little bit of a flippant attitude at the last meeting to just like pass the resolution as it was and like, fund this money, send it out. We got to do this now. And it's like, we could just take like 2 seconds and have a bit of extra information about each of the proposals.
The sponsors yield their time.
Yes, I'd say so.
All right, with that, we'll move into voting procedure on the amendment. No superseding motions. All those in favor of this amendment, raise your placards now.
Yeah, if you want to go grab it, you can.
Or just your hand is fine.
Walking.
All right, all those opposed to this amendment, may raise your placards now. More are being added. Okay. Thank you. All right. And all those abstaining. All right. And with that, in the eyes of the chair, this amendment fails, and the bill is in its original state. All right. We'll now return to question and answer the period. We have 1 minute left. Are there any questions for the sponsors?
I just meant I would suggest maybe to put it at a later date. We could always write an addendum, make it like public if in for the sake of transparency.
Hmm.
We could discuss that.
Yeah, but, public as in the full suite of information, the proposal.
Yeah, some list of like how much funding there was, some list, some brief description of the criteria was selected. Might create some backlash, but I think we could think about giving that transparency. But I think that's something for later because lots of people waiting for this money.
Claire.
Yeah. I think that my question is like with the amount of how vocal y'all were with like forming the special grants committee and having a number of people on it, like, do you think that this transparency is necessary and appropriate? Like, I think that if you had this kind of team working and you came to a consensus and you gave us all the numbers and you did all of this, I just wonder if it's something that is like appropriate because these people might have, I don't know if somebody has concerns, but I just wonder, they thought it's gonna be a very private process and all of a sudden here's their money that they asked for and they didn't get it. And I don't know,
yeah.
Not saying that it's not a good idea. Just wonder.
If I just briefly may state, the goal that I had as chair of this committee was to be as transparent with the GPSA voting members as possible. It's, of course, understandable that when we put out the call for applications, it was not going to be shared widely to the entirety of the Cornell community, but to the best of our ability, we have shared as much information and have been, I hope, as transparent as is reasonable for you to make the decisions that the Special Grants Committee, or understand the decisions the Special Grants Committee came to. And it is up, I think, to the Appropriations Committee at this point to determine what information they do or do not share, due again to the fact that the Special Grants Committee has ceased to exist.
More specifically to your point, I do also think that it may not be in GPSA's best interest broadly and these organizations as well, because we do not want to be inundated for the next 6 years or however long the organization's institutional memory lasts, that, oh, you didn't fund my organization 3 years ago. Like, I hate you, you know, like, so I think that is a good question. And I think maybe that's something that the body should consider.
Thank you, Xander and Jason. Question and answer period has elapsed. We'll now move into commenting period on resolution 11 as it's written. Are there any comments pursuant to this resolution? Going once.
I have a point of information.
Xander is recognized.
Point of information for Eric. Would you be able to pull up the spreadsheet with the you know which one it is off the top of your head, Jason? The spreadsheet with the initial requested amount so that we could at least give the body that information.
I see. I don't recall exactly which one of those. There's quite a few. There's multiple spreadsheets made over the course of the Special Grants Committee. If there's interest in like showing it in front of the GPSA, that's doable. The one that I have off the top of my head was in an email that I sent to the members of the Special Grants Committee after the conclusion of the deadline. So I can send that to Eric if we want to do that now, because I don't know.
Is that meant to be shared?
It's not meant to be shared. It's just I don't think it's on the box in the form that would be easiest for viewing. A lot of the information is scattered across disparate spreadsheets. So I just don't know if it's easily accessible at the moment.
Yeah, Eric.
Sir, Xander, are you talking about from the last meeting, the PowerPoint slide that we shared?
No.
So if you want to go to the box in the spreadsheet, I can look and see if it's
Thank
available.
You. In the meantime, I'll ask, is there any other comments on this resolution 11 as it's currently written?
That was a great idea. We should see that in session.
Perfect point. Thank you, Cameron. are there any other comments on this resolution before we vote on it?
What's the suggestion?
Yeah, so an update is it's not on box, but the Special Grants Committee members should have at least one version of that in their email.
I'm going to motion for a 3 minute recess so we can get this.
Okay, there's been motion for a 3 minute recess. Do I have a second? A second from Cameron. Okay. All those in favor, raise their placard or hands,
and
either works.
Send it.
All right,
Eric.
All those opposed?
No, Eric.
All right, in the eyes of the chair, we're now entering a 3 minute recess.
Reviewing, we're going to try to show it, but I can also make it available on Box. It has a lot of the underlying information about the normalized scores and some of the back end score normalization that I had to do to get the rankings, but that information is in there, so you can see it once Eric gets the thing going. But yeah, it was just shared in the chat, so. Yeah, I made it a PDF. That was my mistake. So, again, with the expectation that this is not designed for viewing at this moment here, what you're looking at is a ranked. Oh, sorry. Oh, no.
I just shared his.
Oh, yeah. That's important. So, once he gets that going, the information is not going to be easily readable by you guys, but I'm going to try to walk you through it as best as I can. So, as a note, the way that I did this is I had in the back end a number of ways of trying to normalize the scores from all of the individual reviewers because we wanted to make sure that we were as fair as possible. So there's a lot of different columns that don't matter, but this is sorted by the average normalized reviewer score. This information by itself is already available in Box without any of the extra columns. So if you can go to the last page, because of the way that it was turned into a PDF, you can't really relate the actual requested funds with the proposals, but we have it here. It is
public. It is available. So if you want it, we can share it. But that's what we got.
Thank you, Jason. Are there any further comments pursuant to Resolution 11? Going once? Going twice? All right, seeing as that has elapsed, we'll now move into voting on the resolution in its current form. Seeing as this requires two-thirds vote, I will ask Eric to call the roll.
Okay.
Ula Elshamid. Jenna Elzer. Vishwa Barua. Nicholas Brennan.
Aye.
B. Candelaria. Ana Fernanda Cardenas.
Aye.
Paul Caruso.
Aye.
Cameron Chappelle.
Aye. Chapel.
Chapel, thank you. Jason Chaburka.
Aye.
Alessandra Coogan.
Aye.
Isako Di Tomasi.
Aye.
She's on, Tim.
I said aye if you didn't hear me.
Thank you. Kelly Ellis. Devin Freeman.
Aye.
Emma Rose Galan.
Aye.
Andy Garcia Ortiz.
Aye.
Irene Gattini.
Aye.
Malta Hassler.
Aye.
Mac James. Yusuf Khalid. Claire King.
Aye.
Anurag Koyada. Zongyan Wu.
Aye.
Xander Lynch.
Aye.
Clarice Mefford. Tian Nguyen.
Aye.
Marilise Ortiz. Raina Prude.
Wait, sorry, could you repeat that?
This is to vote yes or no on Resolution 11.
Oh, wait, yes. Aye.
Thank you. Katie Rohrbaugh.
That was
oh, wait, sorry, that was me. Sorry, I was looking at the transcript and it looked like it could be a misspelling of my name, so I went for it. But my bad.
Gotcha, thank you. Seem set. Aye. Ian Smith. Yuching Wu.
Aye.
Jeffrey Wan. Hong Ji Zhan. Diane Huan.
Aye.
I have the number. Eric, point of information. We have two MBA representatives. If they'd like to announce themselves, they can vote today.
Hello. Thank you all. My name is Liam Laguerre. I'm the treasurer for the Corporate Leadership Club on the MBA program. There's another member from the Corporate Leadership Program also on the call, Victoria Mills. Would love to vote. Seems like we're in a consensus already, but I'll say aye. Also, pleasure to meet you all. Hopefully I can meet you guys in person at some point.
Thank you. And Victoria Mills.
Hi, thanks, Liam. I'm representing a few different Johnson clubs. I'm on the Corporate Leadership Club alongside Liam. I'm the president of the Human Capital Association and the treasurer of the Canadian Business Club. And my vote is aye.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Raina Prude said aye as well.
One moment. Andy's recognized.
Motion to extend the meeting.
And a motion to extend the meeting by a second. Second by Maltese.
But
wait, by how much? You have to specify. Right. 10 minutes. All right. The second. Second from Maltese. Thank you. All right. Is there any objection? Seeing none with 21 in the affirmative, 0 in the negative, and 0 abstaining, the resolution passes. All right. We will now move on to Resolution 12. Resolution 12 sponsors Ana Fernanda Cardenas and Jason Chibirko, who would like to proceed to the front of the room. Resolution 12, implementing special grant committee funding recommendations on grants addressing student lounges. You have 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, so this resolution identifies lack of accessible, welcoming, and functional student lounges in certain areas of campus. It mainly discusses how there's like an absence of dedicated student lounges, limited to opportunities for collaboration, peer support, and wellness and community building, which is so important for the graduate student life on a daily, right? We all know that third spaces, which refers to any space outside of like just like work and home, are so important for people's mental well-being as well as collaborative work. And specifically, one of the reasons I really care about like this brand specifically is like one of them mentioned eating in like near the labs, which is like, first of all, like it's just kind of sad, and like it's so important to create that extra space for all graduate students to feel welcome here at Cornell.
Yeah, no, I echo those points. The main thing I'll highlight is while for many of the grants, these are going towards food costs or other sorts of one-time usage, the student lounges are one of the biggest opportunities for the Graduate Professional Student Assembly to make a lasting impact for many graduate professional students. It is important that while these lounges may be in particular buildings that are frequented by individual programs, that does not mean that they are unavailable or inaccessible to the broader graduate professional students body. It is imperative that all funds that we contribute to these grants, specifically the student lounges, allow for the most amount of graduate professional student benefit over the longest amount of time.
Yeah, and we make sure to mention that like all those spaces that are being funded are accessible to all graduate student and professional students across every department. So like anybody can use the lounges as long as they're welcome and use it.
Yep. All right. With that, we'll move into question and answer period on Resolution 12. Are there any questions for us? We'll go multi-standard.
Yeah, Jason, do you have any update on grant number 3?
Grant,
remember, we want to sponsor heating, and like, is there any confirmation that the university will still at least provide the cost of the heating itself?
Yeah, so in terms of actual information, we have not confirmed or denied that ability for the university itself to fund that. What we do know is that at least when it comes to the AgriTech campus, it seems like they have extensive collaborations with the departments and the other people that are managing the space. So while that question still remains, as we communicate with them, I believe that that money will still go towards the actual funding, and regardless of our amount, that space will be usable and should still be paid for the heating, not by us. That is not something that we are committing to or otherwise requiring as a component of our funding, if that makes sense.
Yeah, my worry is like we spend 15 grand on the heating pump, and then no one is responsible for actually paying the running costs. Yeah, do you have anything?
Yeah, I would just like to speak on behalf of Sages, as I'm a part of it,
please.
Is that like this is like a very well-loved space, and I know that the director of AgriTech and the professors at AgriTech want that space to be usable. My lab talks about using it, so I know I can't promise that like B&P up there, which is our building and property managers, are gonna like do everything what we say, but like we will follow up on the second half, and like there's enough desire that I don't think you're going to pay for a heating pump and then it's just going to sit. Because I was just at a meeting, and when this was even brought up as like being passed through this resolution, everybody was like so excited. So I want to convey that. And also convey that like directors and people in charge of administration up there love this space, and it's been used and lost. That wasn't really succinct, but yeah.
Thanks, Claire.
Yeah.
Other questions for the sponsors, Xander?
I'd like to make an amendment.
Oh, please.
And so my amendment would be on lines between lines 82 and 87 of Revolution Bow. And so the currently the Animal Science Graduate Student Association is would be being distributed $12,500, and one of the conditions is do not fund space renovations. I'd like to I don't know if I need to strike this or if it's contradictory, but I'd like to add an additional condition that they may instead use 4,500 of their already allocated dollars to instead fund a temporary partition. This temporary partition is necessary for this space to be used because the other part of it is like lockers and areas that kind of need to be private. So the temporary partition would allow that area to remain private while the rest of it could be used as a lounge space. So that's the amendment.
If I can rephrase the amendment.
Oh, I'm about to. Yeah. So the amendment reads as follows: under point two for grant number 23, bullet A and B are preserved with the addition of bullet C, that $4,500 may be used to fund a temporary partition as an exception to point A of the amendment. Do the sponsors take that amendment as friendly?
I would say yes.
Friendly.
All right. Seeing with no objection, the resolution is amended as such.
All right, thank you.
Are there any other questions pursuant to resolution 12? One. I'm quite with that question answered period collapsed. We'll now move into comment period. Are there any comments for pursuant to resolution 12? Someone on Zoom? I can't read the name of
Dan.
it. Okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I posed the question in Zoom chat. So some graduate student lounges require departmental card swipe to access. Would you think that would be a concern for the condition that all lounges funded for renovation need to be accessible to all? Like how to understand that accessibility in practice?
Well, that's a fair question. So what I will say is one of the things that people can do and people have done in my department is use those lounges for events. That allows the individuals to organize both a timely event and let people in when the building is locked. I know especially for my building, Biotech, and the nearby Weill, the doors lock and close at 5. So if you don't have card access, you just can't get in. And there are, in fact, many spaces that Biotech has that are open to graduate professional students already that aren't thus accessible based on card access. I don't think, based on this funding, that would otherwise fix the issue that exists, but I think that with these spaces now existing for the ability to host events, that would facilitate other people being able to use the spaces in the case of card access being limited on a time-based basis.
Got it. Thank you.
Any further comments related to resolution 12? Going once, going twice. Seeing none, we'll now move into voting procedure on the resolution. Eric, you may call the roll.
Jim, as soon as I find my connection.
Andrew's there
again.
Then.
Start meeting by 5 minutes.
There's been a motion to extend the meeting by 5 minutes. Do I have a second?
Yes.
Second from Alessandra. Do I have any objections? Without objection, that meeting time will now end at 6:45 p.m. Make sure to air.
Okay. Voting on resolution 12. Leila Al-Shamah. Jenna Elzer. Vishwa Barua. Nicholas Brennan.
Aye.
B. Candelaria.
Fernanda Cardenas.
Aye.
Paul Caruso.
Aye.
Cameron Chaplin.
Aye.
Jason Chiburco.
Aye.
Alessandra Coogan.
Aye.
Isako Di Tomasi.
Sorry, aye.
Kelly Ellis. Devin Freeman.
What was that, Devin?
Devin, could you restate your vote, please?
I know they got him.
That's an aye. Okay. All right. Emma Rose Gawain.
Aye.
Andy Garcia Ortiz.
Aye.
Irene Gattini.
Aye.
Malta Hassler.
Aye.
Mac James. Yusuf Khalid. Claire King.
Aye.
Anurag Koyada. Zongyan Liu.
Aye.
Xander Lynch.
Aye.
Clarice Mefford. Tian Nguyen.
Aye.
Marylise Ortiz. Raina Prude.
Aye.
Katie Rohrbach.
Aye.
Siim Sepp.
Aye.
Ian Smith. Yuching Wu.
Aye.
Jeffrey Wan. Hongji Zhang. Diane Huang.
Aye.
Liam Laguerre.
Aye.
Victoria Mills.
Aye.
Twenty-one to zero to zero.
Thank you. And by a vote of 21 to zero, this resolution passed. We'll now move on to open forum. Are there any points for open forum today? Irene?
So the Brooks School of Public Policy alongside Black in Public Policy, which I am VP of, is hosting an event, Fireside Chat, with Karine Jean-Pierre, the former, press secretary under Joe Biden, is going to be with us in Warren B25 from 6 to 8. So for those that are interested and free or are not sure if they're interested but are free, I would 10 out of 10 recommend attending and having a great time there.
I'm sorry, on what day? Today? Or
what?
What day?
The 27th.
Oh, it's me. No,
yeah,
there you go. Okay. I'll pitch an event also.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, February 25th, so that's Wednesday this week at 6:30 in the Big Red Barn, there'll be free pizza and soft drinks. The Committee on the Future of the American University is having a working session, kind of dream session about what the future of graduate education will look like 50 years into the future. So if you want to have a role in shaping that and shaping Cornell's long-term strategy in a variety of different scenarios, I invite you to come. Hopefully many of us from exec will be there. So. Any other points for open forum, Paul?
I have another event. I kind of over on the Brooks side as well, but the Cornell Negotiation Student Society is having a workshop tomorrow night at 5 o'clock called the Interpersonal Skills of Negotiation. You want to learn how to deal with people who are perhaps angry or how to negotiate in the workplace. It's a great way to learn how to do it and then also practice how to do it. We'll be in MBR 4301. See you there.
Andy.
Additionally, the Botanic Gardens is looking for student input sometime in March. They'll be holding listening sessions I think they're going to talk about some of the newest stuff that's coming through campus planning, which is a Asian-inspired garden.
Yeah, it's a new addition for the Botanical Garden. They're going to do an East Asian garden, trying to get multiple cultures across Asia.
Yes. So they want feedback on a time that would be best for students, lunch hour or evening, as well as some dates. Keep that in mind.
Evening, probably.
Evening, probably. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. But it's going to be held at the Botanic Gardens Welcome Center. So
Nice building.
all right, with that, do I have any motion? Alexander is recognized.
Looking to close the meeting.
Motion to adjourn. Do I have a second? A second from Emma. With that, no objection. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.
Cool.
And
yes, I need to.